you. Good morning, everyone. Thanks to the organizers for inviting me to speak and for putting me on the last session, the very last talk. That's very helpful. We've taken all the math out of the talk. And so it will try to come close to discussing concepts rather than nitty-gritties of Markov chain Monte Carlo methods, for example. My work is essentially in the analysis of health data. I work in the analysis of longitudinal clinical trials, so the design and analysis of longitudinal clinical trials, and specifically with regards count data. So data, either they are some sort of Poisson mixture-based or binomial mixture-based. And so this is work that I've done with Farouk Natu. This is his PhD. This is part of his PhD thesis. And it's a small part that has to do with forestry. As I said, we work in the health field, and so does Farouk. So this is our first foray into the forestry, and it's actually not anything to do with forest fires. It's forest ecology. So as I've said, my focus is the analysis of longitudinal data, clinical trials data, and we're looking at repeated measurements where on each subject over a period of time, and we have a large group of subjects. So one of the problems with the analysis of data in the health realm is variability. There are many different sources of variability. For example, variability from hospitals, from individuals, from families, from some groups that are clustered together in some way. And there are very well-established methods for dealing with the analysis of such data, including generalized linear mixed models, where you account for the variability through random effects. Hidden Markov models, this is where you assume that there are groups, subgroups, populations, subgroups, that you don't know about, but some of them, there are some covariates that are missing, for example, that will cluster the individuals into subgroups. You don't know which individual belongs to which particular subgroup. And one subgroup might be perhaps more resistant to the disease, so the disease progresses slower than for an individual for whom the disease just escalates, the degenerative process. Counting process models are a very big field this day. Anderson, Borger, Gill, Keating. Multi-state models are models that we're going to talk about here, where we're looking at a particular disease and seeing how it evolves over time through particular well-defined stages. Now, in the health context, it's typically assumed that individuals are independent. So now we move into the forestry context. And in the forestry context, we have the additional dimension of space. So statistical methodology for the analysis of longitudinal data now in the forestry context should account for what we call spatial correlation in observations. So here's an example that we'll take through the talk, and it's in forest ecology, as I mentioned. It's a study of white pine trees, weevil infestation, which is a big problem in British Columbia. Apparently, the provincial government is sinking a lot of money into research and analysis for white pine weevil because it's escalated. The problem has escalated in recent years. So these trees have an XY location, and they're examined annually for the presence or absence of infection. So this is a 0-1 data value with an XY, and then you have time. So this is longitudinal binary, longitudinal binary spatial data. So here, we're going to talk about both continuous and discrete mixture models. There are random effects that need to be accounted for in this particular example. The discrete context consists of the example that I just gave in the health context. There are some trees that are resistant to white pine, to weevil infestation, excuse me. And so we need to account for two populations, the resistance and the non-resistance. And there are also random variation. There's also excess random variation than any of the usual models can accommodate, even within these subgroups. Now, of course, with only 7 years of data, there are individuals who would randomly have no infestation for the seven-year cycle. So it's not a matter simply of dividing the population into two groups based on the zeros. We actually want to use a method of estimating this, taking into account pooling of information from small locales that might say whether or not an individual is really resistant. So the focus in this talk is on spatial mixed multi-state models, and we've got to the point where we've developed some methods and have explored them. What we need to do now is to get back with Fang Liang, he, and with the researcher at the Ministry of Forests, and talk now about the forestry context. So what does this mean in the forestry context? And I'm sorry that Fang Liang had to leave yesterday, because I was hoping to get some feedback from him on this particular matter. So this is spatial mixed multi-state models in a forestry context. And I will actually let Farooq go through the talk. Farooq's the student who's worked on this with me, and he's at the end of his PhD work. And so hopefully we can entice him to move away from the health realm into the forestry realm.
Okay, thanks, Remy. So before I present some of the spatial methodology that we've developed, I'll provide a brief overview of multi-state models. And then I'll discuss a particular example that we've worked on. After that example, I'll talk more generally about some continuous time models we've developed. And then Charmaine is going to come back and discuss some extensions and current work that we're doing. Okay, so multi-state models. So these models are commonly used in the analysis of longitudinal data. And they're particularly useful when interest lies in the dynamic properties of the process or processes under investigation. And so a multi-state model is a model for a stochastic process, which at any point in time will occupy one of a discrete set of states. And depending on the context, these states can represent, for example, the health status of an individual, or they can summarize states of disease activity. And as subjects are observed over time, they can make changes from one state to another, and we refer to such a change of state as a transition. And so, for example, in studies of disease, subjects can make transitions between a diseased and a disease-free state. And so, okay, one of the key elements of a multi-state model is known as the state structure. And the state structure is going to summarize the states that can be occupied and what possible state-to-state transitions that can be made. So, for example, in a study of disease, a simple two-state structure can be useful, where at any point in time, subjects will either be in a diseased or a disease-free state, and they make transitions between the two states, and we're interested in the transition rates, so the disease rates and the disease resolution rates. And I guess for disease studies of very long duration, mortality can become a factor. And so in that scenario, perhaps models with a three-state structure, where we now incorporate a state representing death, could be useful. In this case, we'd be interested, again, in disease rates and also mortality rates. So that's the state structure. So we're interested in modeling the process governing transition. So we're interested in transition probabilities or quantities derived from transition probabilities. So for example, if we observe a process in discrete time that, say, takes one of k states at any point in time, often we might be interested in modeling, for example, the one-step transition probability. So here I've denoted it by Pij of t. And so what is this? This is the probability that the process is in state I at time t minus 1 and then makes a transition into state j at time t. And so for continuous time processes, we're interested in analogous quantities known as transition intensity functions. And so the transition intensity function associated with transitions from, say, some state I to some state j is defined by the following quantity here. And so this is, as you can see, defined in terms of a limit of transition probabilities. So when doing multi-state modeling, a common assumption that one makes, so a common simplifying assumption, is the Markov assumption. And so this is where one assumes that the entire history of the process up to time t is captured by the current state occupied at that time. And while many complex processes may not exhibit this type of Markov dependence, Markov processes are still useful as they can be used as building blocks in a hierarchical framework used to specify more complex models. And indeed, these more complex models are often useful, particularly when there are a large number of subjects observed. There can be a great deal of heterogeneity in the transition processes corresponding to different subjects. And heterogeneity in the transition processes can be accommodated in several ways. I guess the most obvious and simplest way would be through regression models. So here we would have some type of regression of, say, transition probabilities on vectors of subject-specific covariates. A second alternative for accounting for heterogeneity, and perhaps, I guess, a bit more advanced, would be through the use of random effect models. And there has been some work done on incorporating random effects into multi-state models, work by Richard Cook and Paul Albert. And in these models, random effects are assumed to be independent over subjects. And a third alternative for dealing with heterogeneity in a Markov chain analysis would be through the use of finite mixtures. And these models are particularly useful if it is believed that there exists some subgroup within the population that is making transitions according to some very special process. And so for those of you that know it, a classic example of this would be the mover-stayer model, where it is assumed that there is some subgroup of subjects whose initial state is absorbing. So these models are more sophisticated than standard Markov models, particularly the second and third, but the work that's out there in the literature still makes this assumption of independence between subjects. And of course, in forestry, where, for example, the subjects are trees spatially arranged in some region, this is likely to not hold. So now what I'll do is I'll present a model which relaxes this assumption. And in fact, the model I'll present incorporates all three of these ideas. We incorporate regression modeling, random effect modeling, and we also account for special subgroups using a finite mixing distribution. Okay, so before I present the model, let me describe a little bit more the study for which the model was built. So the study involves a plantation of white pine trees, and the size of this plantation is roughly 22,000 square meters. And inside this plantation, there's about 3,000 white pine trees, and each of these trees is susceptible to weevil infection. And so during the course of the study, each tree was examined at regular annual intervals for either the presence or absence of weevil infection since the previous year. And so in the multi-state framework, trees are going to be observed in one of two states, either an infected state or an uninfected state. And they're going to make transitions between these two states. And so the objective in our analysis here was to describe the transition process between the states and characterize variation in this process over space and time. So again, these trees are spatially arranged, so it's quite reasonable to assume that these weevil infections or these weevil attacks are going to occur in clusters throughout the region, and so that's going to induce spatial similarity or spatial correlation in the disease status of these trees. But spatial dependence aside, there was actually another interesting feature to this data, and that was this, that 27% of the trees were simply never infected throughout the course of the study. So we have this large proportion of the trees, roughly one-third, that were just never infected. So I guess there are several explanations that one might think for this, and one that we decided to explore was this notion of resistant trees. So a resistant tree is a tree for which, for unknown reasons, has an extremely low probability of infection and is thus always observed in the uninfected state. Okay, so just a bit of notation first. I'm going to let state 1 denote the infected state and state 0 denote the uninfected state. So again, in this study, trees are going back and forth between state 1 and state 0. And I'm going to denote the state occupied by the ith tree at year t by a binary variate yi of t. And associated with this binary variate is a corresponding vector of covariates, xi of t, which are tree-specific covariates and which will vary with time. Okay, so the response obtained from the ith tree in the study is therefore a vector of binary values, a binary time series, indicating the sequence of states occupied during the study. So to model the data, we specify a hierarchical model where at the first level of the model, we assume that each response vector, each of the binary response vectors yi, is independently drawn from a two-component mixture model, one component having a density f1 and another component having a density f0. And this quantity here is a scalar parameter and it's a mixing probability, so I'll get into that a bit later. So the density f0 here, associated with the second component of the model, is the density of a degenerate distribution which places all its mass on the zero vector. And it's this component of the mixture that's going to account for the resistant trees, because of course the resistant trees are always going to be in the uninfected state and they will therefore yield a zero vector as their response. So the density F1 associated with the first component of the model is the density of a first order two-state Markov chain characterized by an initial state probability and transition probabilities between the two states, and the transition probabilities will vary over the trees and over time. So to model this variation, we adopt logistic linear specifications of the following form. And so as you can see, the forms contain three components. And so I'll go through each component in these forms and talk about what they represent. So the first component is a regression component. And so here, we allow the transition probabilities to be modulated by vectors of tree-specific covariates. And in particular, in our analysis of this weevil infestation data, we incorporated two covariates. So the first covariate, which I call DI, is a local measure of tree density. And so how is this obtained? For each tree, we obtained the total number of trees within a radius of 10 meters. And so this gives you, this is a local measure of tree density in a small region surrounding each tree. And the second covariate was obtained in a similar manner. It's a time-varying covariate, and it's a local measure of infection density at the previous time point. So again, to obtain this for each tree at the previous time point, we obtain the total number of neighboring trees within a radius of 10 meters that were infected in the previous year. Okay, so those are the covariates, the regression component. The second component are these functions G0 and G1 of time. And these are meant to describe and represent overall temporal trends or global trends in the transition probabilities. And to represent these, we adopted a flexible method based on cubic B-splines. And the final component of the specification are these quantities B0 and B1. And so these are tree-specific random effects, and the random effects are used to model spatial correlation in the transition. So associated with each tree are two random effects. And so as a result, the model is going to contain two vectors of random effects, B0 and B1. And at the second level of our model, we're going to assume that each of these vectors is independently drawn from a conditional autoregressive or CAR model. And so the CAR model is a Markov random field model where the joint distribution for a collection of spatially correlated random variables is determined through a set of local specifications. So Professor Brillinger in his talk referred to BASAG models, and so I believe he was alluding to these types of models here. And so CAR models have found wide application, particularly in disease mapping, as well as their initial application, which was in image analysis. Okay, so what type of CAR model are we going to use to model the random effect? So in particular, we're going to adopt Gaussian CAR models, or autonormal models as they're called. And so these models are based on the following set of conditional specifications. So let me go through these. So here we would assume that the random effect, or a random effect associated with the ith tree, conditional on all the other random effects, is going to have a normal distribution with a conditional mean mu I and a conditional variance sigma I squared. And so here's the expression for the conditional mean. And as you can see, it's written as a weighted average of all the other random effects. And it's this weighted average that we use to build the spatial dependence. The weight, Wij, acting on tree I and tree j, is going to depend on the distance between tree I and tree j. And there are several forms that one might adopt for these weights. So for example, one might adopt a simple 0-1 weight structure, where you might say, okay, the weight Wij is 1 if the distance between tree I and tree j is less than or equal to some pre-specified distance d, and 0 otherwise. And then you can obtain this value d from an exploratory analysis. And I guess if you wanted to get really fancy, you could incorporate d as a parameter into your model, which would be kind of neat. But you might not want this 0-1 weight structure. You might want a weight structure which decays smoothly as the distance between trees increases. So as an example of this, you might take the weight to be the inverse exponential of the distance between trees. And of course, any positive decreasing function of distance is going to work here. All right, so overall, we have a two-state model, which allows for a subpopulation of resistant trees. So in the mover-stayer terminology, these would be the stayers. And trees which do make transitions do so according to a Markov chain incorporating spatially correlated random effects. And so these are the movers in the mover-stayer terminology. And so here is the state structure of our model, which summarizes the key idea. So we have an uninfected and an infected state. And within the uninfected state, we have the stayers, or the resistant trees, who will always remain in this state. And then, of course, trees that can make transitions do so according to this spatial Markov chain. Okay, so that's the model specification. And so having specified the model, let's talk a bit about estimation and inference. So we've approached this from both the classical and the Bayesian perspectives, and we've developed methodology and software in both settings. So in the classical framework, we use maximum likelihood. And in particular, the quantity that we're interested in, or the quantity that we want to optimize to get our estimates, is the marginal likelihood function, which can be written as an expected value of some quantity with respect to the distribution of the random effects. So we're averaging some quantity over our mixing distribution. In a Bayesian framework, inference is based on the posterior distribution, which takes up to a normalizing constant the following form. Of course, in a Bayesian setting, we need to specify a prior distribution for our model parameters. And so here I denote the prior distribution by pi of theta. And in our analysis of this data, we employed relatively vague prior distribution. And we conducted a sensitivity analysis adopting different forms of vague prior distributions. And this was to ensure that the form of these prior distributions were not having an appreciable effect on the results. And in fact, they seem to be quite robust to the form of vague prior that we in fact choose. All right, so in both cases, the quantity that we're interested in is defined in terms of high-dimensional integrals. So for example, the likelihood function is defined in terms of this expectation. And for this particular example, this is an integral whose dimension is in the thousands. So a natural approach to fitting the model is then to use techniques based on Markov chain Monte Carlo simulation, or MCMC. And so, of course, this is straightforward in the Bayesian framework. We simply draw MCMC samples from our posterior distribution and then use these samples to summarize aspects of our posterior distribution. In the likelihood framework, we use the Monte Carlo EM algorithm to obtain maximum likelihood estimates, or I should say approximate maximum likelihood estimates. So course, all the statisticians are going to be familiar with the EM, or expectation maximization algorithm. So for those of you that aren't, the EM algorithm is a very commonly used algorithm for obtaining MLEs and missing data problems. And of course, it applies to mixture models, because you can treat the random effects as missing data and work in an EM framework. So that's good, but unfortunately, the E step of a standard EM algorithm is not available in closed form for our model. And so to get past this intractability, what we do is at each E step, we employ Monte Carlo integration. And in particular here, we employed the Gibbs sampler. Okay, so a bit more on Monte Carlo EM. It's not going to possess the usual monotonicity properties of a standard EM algorithm. And of course, it's these properties that one uses to prove that algorithm is going to converge to a local maxima of the likelihood function. However, under a broad set of conditions, it will converge to a neighborhood of the MLE and then vary randomly about this neighborhood. And of course, the size of this neighborhood is going to depend on the Monte Carlo sample size you adopt at each iteration of the algorithm. And so there are several ways of assessing convergence of the algorithm, and the simplest being just examining the trace plots of the parameters at each iteration. And so I'll give an example of that in a moment. But first, let me just touch on standard error. So once we have our estimates, we again use MCMC to approximate the observed information matrix. Okay, so here, what I have here is Monte Carlo EM output for 8 of the parameters in our model as it was fit to the data. And so what you can see here, so each plot corresponds to a different parameter. And what you can see here is that starting from some initial value, the current estimate of the parameter at each iteration moves and moves and moves and eventually stabilizes around some value. And so the idea is, and again, this is the simplest way of assessing convergence, you simply examine these plots for each parameter of your model. And then once all of the plots seem to have stabilized, you can stop the algorithm and declare convergence. Or alternatively, and this is what we did, you can run the algorithm for a few more iterations with a very large Monte Carlo sample size, the objective there being to decrease the Monte Carlo error. Okay, so that's the model fitting. So let me just present some of the results of the analysis. So we found that the results obtained from the Bayesian and likelihood procedures were very similar. And I guess this is not so surprising, since we adopted these weakly informative prior distributions. So as an example of the similarity, consider the estimates of the mixing probability. So they're very similar here, the posterior means and the MLE. And what does this mean in terms of the problem? Well, roughly, you might say that 10% of the trees within the region might be considered to be these resistant trees. Again, recall that we included covariates in our model, and we found that one of the covariates had a particularly strong effect on the transition probabilities, and this was intuitive. I would have been surprised if this was not the case. This was the local measure of infection density at the previous time point. So what the effect implies is the following, that trees surrounded by a larger number of infected trees at the previous time point are more likely to make a transition into the infected state at the next time point. So, I mean, that, of course, jives with my intuition, so that was good. We can also obtain estimates of the temporal trends. So, again, these are the trends represented by these functions G0 and G1, which we modeled using splines. And so the top row here of the figure are the maximum likelihood estimates, and the bottom row are the posterior means from the Bayesian analysis. And so, okay, what do these mean? These are giving you an idea of the overall global temporal trends in the transition probabilities of the movers, of the non-resistant trees. Okay, so as additional output from a model, we can also estimate the random effects. And so what do these random effects represent? They represent missing covariates, so they're residuals. In a way, they're spatially referenced residuals. And so they can be used to obtain maps of the unmodeled heterogeneity. And these maps might be useful because they might pinpoint areas where one might search for missing covariates. So as an example of this, these maps were obtained from the Bayesian analysis. So there are two vectors of random effects in the model, and so I have correspondingly two maps. And so how did I obtain these maps? Well, given the estimates of the vector of random effects, I mark the locations of those 200 trees with the largest values in red, and those 200 trees with the smallest value in green. And so examining the maps, spatial clustering of the large and small values is evident. And so maybe something's going on here. Maybe we can go to this region and examine it and see what exactly is happening there. And so I think scientists would find these type of maps useful. Okay, so B0 is modulating the probability of transition from the uninfected state to the infected state. So a tree which has a large value of B0 has an above average probability of transition into the infected state. And then B1 is the converse. Okay. All right, so that presents the data analysis. So of course we have to validate our model. And so let me talk briefly about goodness of fit. I do this using the posterior predictive distribution. And so for those of you that are not familiar with this, it's the posterior distribution of a hypothetical replicate data set collected under the same conditions as our observed data. And so, well, the idea is really simple, really. If the model fits reasonably well, then the observed data should look plausible under this distribution. So in practice, what we do is we simulate replicate data sets from the posterior predictive distribution, and we compare these to the observed data. And of course, any systematic differences between the data simulated from our model and the observed data may be an indication of model misfit. So as an example of this applied to our analysis, what did I do here? So I simulated 100 replicate data sets from the posterior predictive distribution. And for each of these replicate data sets, I calculated a statistic. And the statistic was the total number of transitions from the uninfected state to the infected state summed over all trees. And so the histogram of that statistic over the 100 replications is given in the top figure. And I also calculated another statistic, which was the total number of transitions from the infected to the uninfected state. And so these histograms represent the posterior predictive distributions of those quantities. And the red lines here represent the observed value of these quantities in our data. And so as you can see, they look quite plausible under the posterior predictive distribution. So what does that really mean? It means that with respect to this aspect of our data, modeling the total number of transitions, there is no evidence of model misfit here. Okay, so that's a little bit of goodness of fit. Another thing that we might do is we might go back and look at some of the assumptions that we made when building our model, and we might try and verify whether these assumptions hold. And so here's an example of this. Recall, there are two vectors of random effects in this model. And each of these vectors represents a vector of spatially correlated random variables. Well, one of the assumptions we made was that these two vectors were independent of one another. So having estimated the random effects, we can plot them against each other. And, well, unfortunately, it doesn't appear to be the case. There appears to be a negative correlation within the pair of tree-specific random effects. So, okay, well, it's actually kind of intuitive if you think about it. What does it mean? It means that those trees which have an above average probability of transition into the infected state, so large values of B0, have a correspondingly lower than average probability of transition into the uninfected state. So in other words, there seems to be this negative correlation between the transition probabilities. And another way of looking at that in the simplest possible way is if you do bad in one state, you're going to do bad in the other. That's what this is showing us. Okay, so it's intuitive, but unfortunately, our model doesn't allow for this. So we should now expand our model. And in fact, what we now seek is a joint spatial model for the two vectors, B0 and B1, because now there's two types of correlation that we want to model. We want to model the spatial correlation, but we also want to model the correlation within the pairs of tree-specific random effects. And to do this, we employ a generalization of the CAR model, the bivariate CAR model. And the bivariate CAR model is, again, a multivariate Markov random field model. And it is specified through conditional specifications for the pair of random effects associated with the ith tree given by the following form. So it's similar in spirit to the univariate case, we assume that the conditional distribution for the ith pair of random effects, so for the ith tree, conditional on all the other pairs, has a bivariate normal distribution with a conditional mean vector and a conditional covariance matrix. And again, the mean vector is written as a linear combination of all the other random effects, where now, of course, the weights are replaced by 2x2 weight matrices. And, of course, this can be generalized. For models with more than two states, multivariate car models are defined in a similar manner. All right, so now I'd like to move away from that specific example and that data analysis and talk more generally about continuous time models we've developed for spatially referenced event history data or spatially referenced multivariate survival data. So we've developed these models in another context, not the forestry context, but they can certainly be applied to the forestry context. For example, you might consider the following continuous time four-state model, which could be used for tree infection, where you might have one state representing a healthy tree and then states two and three representing different levels of infection, perhaps moderate and severe, and then you might have a fourth state representing tree mortality. So what do these models allow one to do? So firstly, they allow you to describe the transition rates while at the same time accounting for spatial correlation. And secondly, they enable one to identify and map spatial variation in these rates. So we're observing a set of these continuous time processes over some spatially referenced field, so trees within a forest, if you like. And so I'm going to let XLST represent the state occupied by subject or tree L, if you want, at T, where T is now indexed from a continuous set. And so in our model, we specify, again, a hierarchical model where at the first stage of the model, we assume that the processes corresponding to the different subjects are independent, with each following a continuous time Markov chain. And the continuous time Markov chain is characterized by its transition intensity functions. And so here I let lambda I j L of t denote the intensity function associated with transitions from state I to state j for subject L. And so it's defined by the following quantity here. And so again, this is analogous to the hazard function in survival analysis. All right, so to model the transition intensity functions, we adopt a proportional intensities model. And here, lambda ij0 is a baseline intensity function common to all subjects. ZL is a vector of subject-specific covariates, and beta ij is the corresponding vector of regression coefficients. So we have a regression component. And again, we have random effects. And so here, bij is a vector of random effects, allowing for spatial correlation in transitions from state I to state J. All right, so modeling the transition intensity functions, there are several ways you can, I mean, there are many ways you can go about this, but so we've examined two. So the first is using splines. And in particular, we represent the log of the transition intensity function as a linear combination of basis functions. A simpler method would be to adopt simple parametric forms, for example, a Weibull form. And these can be useful depending on how complicated of a nonlinear structure you have for your intensity function. Of course, the models of splines take a little longer to run because, of course, the splines, in order to calculate the cumulative intensity, you need to use numerical integration. It's a one-dimensional integral, so it's not hard, but it adds another level of complexity to our NCMC schemes. Okay, the random effects. So the model is going to contain a separate vector of random effects, bij, for each possible I to j transition. And so to make this more concrete, so in the model that I was describing earlier with this four-state structure, so a model with this state structure would have five vectors of random effects, one for each of the five possible types of transitions that you see here that are allowed by the state structure. And so again, at the second level of the model, we assume that the random effects follow a multivariate conditional autoregressive model. And so this model is going to allow for spatial correlation in the transitions as well as correlation between the different transition rates. And so we saw in the first example that this is useful. And finally, let me just touch again on model fitting and inference. It's the same as before. We can apply both Bayesian and frequentist methods based on MCMC. And so now I'll turn the floor back over to Charmaine to wrap things up.
I want to make a few connections with what we've seen over the conference period. Okay, so, but first let me talk about a few extensions to this model. There's one in particular that I want to talk on, and that's this one. Let's skip the other ones. Space-varying coefficient models. That seems to be a feature that we've seen in this particular analysis and in another analysis that Sylvia Esterby would remember, although I say this is my first foray into the analysis of forestry ecology data. That's not quite true. Sylvia Esterby kindly involved me in analysis of forestry data, which I'm going to spend a couple of minutes talking about and explain why we might think that space-varying coefficient models. In this particular analysis, we just incorporated a single trend effect. The trend effect was global overall space. So the trend effect that was presented there, but perhaps not discussed in detail, was a declining trend towards transitions from the infected to the uninfected state over time. What I've seen in other situations, and let me give you an example that has come from Sylvia. We've got several hundred locations in the Okanagan, and where these are cherry trees. This is a cherry tree orchard, or maybe actually all the cherry tree orchards in the Okanagan. Is that right? Apple tree orchards in the Okanagan. And so you might consider these orchards as being defined like this, with perhaps different management structures and those sorts of features we haven't included yet. But let's just take the feature that I'm trying to discuss here. With each tree, we have counts of numbers of a particular event every week over the whole summer. So I think that's there are 30 counts over the summer. And we have that at XY locations for several hundred trees. So you can take a single tree and analyze the data and get a nice picture of what's going on over time for a particular summer, and we have this for several summers as well, so there's a year effect. So there's one particular year, and what's happening is something like this. A small peak followed by a big peak, and you can analyze that for several of the different locations in space and get the same sort of picture. But what we see happening is the peaks are varying spatially. And so in the particular model that we've discussed here, the trend effect is simply a global trend effect. What we would like to be able to do is to isolate how the peaks are moving spatially over time. Not over time. Mornings are really bad for me. How the peaks are moving over space, over the Okanagan region, and then also what's happening from year to year. And see, so these are in the concept of space-varying coefficient models. Now, these models are fitted by... Now, so this is a connection with John. And it's not quite a good connection, but it's a somewhat of a connection. This is count data. So we have the number of occurrences of some event for 30 times over a particular summer, and we have that replicated hundreds of times here. What we've done is we've fitted a spline model to this. So the new development here is how to fit a spline model adaptively to count data. So we have recurrences coming in. We don't just want to fit a non-homogeneous Poisson process. We want to be able to figure out where the knots should be adaptively. And so that's been another venture of study for another PhD student, Jason Nielsen. Now, you use kernel methods. We thought of using spline methods, and then we thought, okay, how can we adapt it? And we thought initially, well, this is going to be a breeze, because if you're familiar with generalized linear models, you can take generalized linear models and consider them in the iterative reweighted least squares framework. And then it starts to look like a least squares, a normal framework. And so with the normal framework for normal models, there are tons of methods for handling adaptive splines, so figuring out where to put the knots and how many knots to put. In the count process recurrence model, there isn't anything that's available. And so we thought, okay, first, no problem, change it into an iterative reweighted least squares framework and then see whether we can import some of these normal theory methods and create a scheme for adaptive spline. Well, it didn't work, but we've now created a scheme for adaptive spline. And so this is now what we want to do is extend that into the spatial framework. What other connections can I make? Watson talked about modeling the number of fires over the number of lightning strikes over a grid. And somebody else talked about over a grid too. There was somebody who had a map and then overlaid on the map these polygons. Was that coming? I don't know if... Right. Okay. And so there was a mean that was estimated for each of these polygons. Is that right? And in Watson's case, there was a logistic regression that was done for the number of fires over the number of strikes. Well, I think there is a scope for incorporating spatial correlation in these models. And seeing if the spatial correlation gives you better predictivity. And if it doesn't, then that's fine. But I think there's a scope for expanding these models to account for spatial correlation as we've tried to do here with the spatial multi-state models. So adaptive spine. And then finally, what we would like to do, at least in the health context, is integrate. So Song isn't here today. So integrate this into GIS spatial. Oh, yes, you are. Right, sorry. So GIS works on its own. The geographers would say there's a lot of spatial tools in GIS, but there aren't, for example, sophisticated spatial tools that take account of some of the methods, for example, that we've talked about here. And so what we would like to do is we would like to produce a toolbox that can be incorporated into the GIS methodology so that when you have health data, so for the number of cancer cases in a particular local health area, which is the sorts of analyses that I've been looking at, then what you can do is, you can have a website that's available for the whole province. So a local health manager in a particular region can develop trends for his particular region, not just on his data, but maybe by pooling with neighboring regions, by looking at the map globally, and then zoning in, okay, this is my area, what are my trends, etc. These trends are highly variable for the small areas, as you can expect, and this is why we started working on these methods. So I'll give you a very interesting example. The Ministry of Health produces these maps of mortality, and there is a 10%, there is a particular budget that's allocated to soft funding. So If they see, for example, one year in Prince George, they saw that there was a lot of suicide deaths. And so what they would do is they would go out into Prince George region and say, okay, we're going to start up a soft funding project where we will go into the schools. We will produce ads for the Prince George region and put them on television. We will open up a few local offices in the regions and see what happens over time and then pull out if everything seems to be stabilized, or move it from the soft funding portfolio into a fixed funding portfolio if we see that this needs long-term effort. So one particular year, there was a lot of deaths, a lot of mortality in a particular region for a particular cause, and the deputy minister said, yes, okay, we're going to put some money into there. And then the next year, of course, there's these meetings to reassess, and the mortality rate had dropped substantially, and it was now way below, right in the lower quartile. And the deputy minister had remembered from the year before and just issued words of congratulation and wanted to know, okay, what had they done? You know, what particular steps had they taken? And as it turned out, they had assigned money to that particular region for that problem, but nothing got implemented because there were a series of delays that had caused that nothing. And they were actually going to report that they would be addressing it the next year. They had some problems in starting. So this was natural variation, a small region, really high one year, really low the other year. And then that's when they started thinking, well, maybe we should do this a little bit differently. And so they started talking to some people to help with them. Anyway, so I see the scope for links in here, and we're at the we need to recontact and see what's whether there's anything interesting here in these methods for the forestry ecologists, and we have one here today. So I think this is not moving anywhere, so it must be done. So thank you very much.
One question about that correlation you saw between the random effect. I'm wondering if when you went and updated them, if you did get a correlation. Because, and the reason I'm wondering that is that